You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Claire Dalton.
In looking at these relationships, then, recent theorists have drawn the following analogies. Isabel Marcus has argued that abusive relationships continue the practice of coverture, the legal structure which denied the separate legal existence of married women and merged their identities with those of their husbands, who had exclusive control of their property and earnings and exclusive authority over the children of the marriage. Marcus says, coverture was a designation of limitation and exclusion. It encoded beliefs regarding women's capacity and competence to act in the world. It confirmed and validated a sex-based locus of virtually unaccountable control in a marital relationship. It was a manifestation of cultural consciousness and a statement about the condition of citizenship. The continuation of the violence and the at times lethal level of resistance on the part of men to efforts to divest them of privilege are contemporary manifestations of the practice of coverture in the United States. Simply put, coverture cannot be said to have disappeared when its essential enforcement mechanism is available and widely used to maintain power and control in a marriage. Marcus argues further that coverture is imposed by a strategy that approximates terrorism. There are strong and striking parallels and similarities, she says, between terrorism as a strategy used to destabilize a community or society consisting both of men and women, and the abuse and violence perpetrated against women in intimate or partnering situations. Like terror directed at a community, violence against women is designed to maintain domination and control, to enhance or reinforce advantages, and to defend privileges. Like other individuals or communities who experience politically motivated terrorism, women whose partnering and intimate relationships are marked by violence directed against them live in a world similarly punctuated by traumatic and/or catastrophic events, such as threats and humiliation, stalking and surveillance, coercion and physical violence. Joyce McConnell has likened the situation of the abused woman to the plight of those relieved not just from slavery, but from involuntary servitude by the passage of the 13th Amendment. While she properly resists the analogy to slavery, calling it both inaccurate and inherently racist, she suggests the following ways in which the life of an abused woman parallels a life under involuntary servitude. The creation of slave-like conditions through the private use of force, the control of all aspects of the woman's life, the forced performance not only of economic production and domestic tasks, but of personal services such as sex and reproduction, the abuser's controlling of food, water, medicinal care, movement, formal education, religion, and familial affiliation, deprivation, beatings, maimings, whippings, rape, murder, torture, starvation, and the ever-present threat of any of them, the constant threat and actual separation of mothers from children and other family members from one another. There is a powerful connection between Marcus's suggestion that modern-day enforcers of coverture are terrorists and the terrorism practiced in the post-Civil War era by those unwilling to yield the privileges of slave ownership. A third theorist, Robin West, looks not at the 13th Amendment, but the 14th. The passage of the 13th Amendment was not enough as a practical matter to abolish slavery. The continued enforced subordination of former slaves through economic coercion and private violence allowed the continuation of slavery by other means, and law enforcement at the state level turned a blind eye. The passage of the 14th Amendment was viewed as a necessary next step for the federal government to step in and ensure that state authority was not complicit in upholding the private authority of former slave owners. West argues that historically, the Equal Protection Clause was understood as challenging the dual sovereignty under which slaves lived. The citizen lives under the rule of only one sovereign, the state, while the slave lives under the rule of at least two sovereigns, the state and the master. The plainest possible meaning of the 14th Amendment mandate is that no state may deny to any citizen the protection of its criminal and civil law against private violence and private violation. Put differently, no state may, through denials of protection, permit any citizen to live in a state of dual sovereignty. Only the state shall have access to the use of unchecked and uncheckable violence to effectuate its will, and then, of course, only with due process. No citizen shall be subject to uncheckable violence by anyone other than the state. Any relationship of sovereignty between a subject and master, other than that between state and citizen, that exists through state acquiescence, a refusal of the state to deter the credible threat of violence on which sovereignty depends, is evidence that the state has violated this guarantee of protection. No state, through the withdrawal of the protections and empowerments of its civil law, shall permit any group to establish sovereignty by isolating one group from the shared, cooperative, and competitive economic life of the whole, thereby exposing that group or individual to natural threats to survival. To the extent, then, that abusive relationships create dual sovereignty, as West believes they do, to the extent that they can be analogized to involuntary servitude, as Joyce McConnell suggests, to the extent they continue the practice of coverture, as Marcus argues, and to the extent the state is ineffective in addressing these evils, to that extent women are precluded from civic participation in the sense of enjoying the rights as equal citizens that the state has formally granted them. This is the first sense, then, in which private violence impacts women's civic participation. However, there is a second sense in which violence against women affects their civic participation. Participation now meaning their contribution to civic life, public debate, or political engagement. To assess this second impact, we need to define the conditions for civic participation and interrogate what we know about what violence does to women to understand the extent to which we might expect women in abusive relationships to be active citizens. In this age of widespread political disengagement, amidst all the claims of media manipulation and the power of the soundbite, amidst all of the concern about the extent to which today's citizenry are disassociating from the practices of citizenship de Tocqueville found so characteristic of Americans, it is difficult to make confident claims about what it takes to be civically, politically active. The preconditions I've chosen to enumerate here may, in this context, seem a little utopian. There are certainly many in America today who don't enjoy them all, and not only because they are victims of private violence. But they are all rooted in our democratic tradition, and they are surely a part of what we would want to see available to every active participant in our political and civil life. First, one needs a certain minimum independence of thought and spirit, the capacity to identify one's own interests and one's own opinions, the capacity to reach relatively confident judgments, and not to be fearful of expressing them or acting on them. Then one needs sufficient personal experience outside the parameters of one's own family and home so that one's opinions and judgments are not derived from too narrow a perspective. One needs the liberty or the leisure to acquire information beyond the scope of one's own experience, whether through formal education or employment, or through books, newspapers, magazines, radio, or television. One needs the freedom to associate with others. In contexts where experiences and opinions can be aired and discussion can inform and temper the conclusions of the participants, One needs opportunities to participate in democratic processes, to exercise political muscle, whether in the context of a faith community, a PTA, a neighborhood association, or a political interest group. And not to be forgotten, one must be guaranteed the opportunity to vote. At every level, these conditions are compromised or unavailable to women living long-term in abusive relationships, as my earlier account of those relationships has suggested. Women in abusive relationships are too often systematically denied the opportunity to think for themselves and systematically taught to doubt their own capacity for rational thought and judgment. They are isolated from opportunities to broaden their horizons, or indeed even to raise their eyes to the horizon. Their attention is focused on that narrow sphere of domestic reality where they may, with sufficient vigilance, be able to avoid or mitigate the violence that constantly threatens. They are often constrained in their participation in education or employment and robbed of the leisure or capacity to read or reflect. They have no or very little freedom of association, whether it is outright coercion, constant surveillance, shame, or exhaustion that stands in the way. No context in which they can challenge the worldview imposed by their abuser. Certainly no context in which they can experience themselves as agents in collective decision-making. And at the most fundamental level, many women in abusive relationships will be unable on any given election day to get to the voting booth. This, then, is the second way in which violence affects women's civic participation. However, this is not the place to stop. I want instead to end with two final thoughts, one designed to rescue us from the despair that looking too closely at women's ongoing subjection can instill, and one designed to underscore the urgency of making progress towards women's full and equal civic participation in both the senses we have discussed it. So for my optimistic moment, a third way in which violence against women has influenced women's civic participation is that it has galvanized many women into political action, into civic engagement, at every level from grassroots organizing to political office at the state and federal level. And many of these women are themselves survivors of violence, turning private pain to public good, demonstrating the resilience of the human spirit and the confidence that we can, as a society, live up to our professed ideals of equality. The second and final thought takes me back one last time to John Stuart Mill and to the observation that the impact of violence against women is felt not just by women, but by all of us, and that we all stand to gain by committing ourselves and the state more strongly to its eradication. As Mill writes, "The example afforded and the education given to the sentiments by laying the foundation of domestic existence upon a relation contradictory to the first principles of social justice must, from the very nature of man, have a perverting influence of such magnitude that it is hardly possible with our present experience to raise our imaginations to the conception of so great a change for the better as would be made by its removal. All that education and civilization are doing to efface the influences on character of the law of force and replace them by those of justice remains merely on the surface as long as the citadel of the enemy is not attacked. If no authority, not in its nature temporary, were allowed to one human being over another, society would not be employed in building up propensities with one hand, which it has to curb with the other. The child would really, from the first time in man's existence on earth, be trained in the way he should go. And when he was old, there would be a chance that he would not depart from it. But so long as the right of the strong to power over the weak rules in the very heart of society, the attempt to make the equal right of the weak the principle of its outward actions will always be an uphill struggle. Isabel Marcus puts the same thought in more contemporary, and I would say impatient, language. Nothing about the model of patriarchy even begins to suggest how the mothers into whose care the males of our society entrust our future citizens can likely inculcate in them a love of the liberty and equality that these same women have been denied. It is remarkable that the young of this society ever grow up to be Democrats. From a practical standpoint, therefore, it can be nothing other than a mistake for democracy to be married to patriarchy, since patriarchy is barren of democratic values and cannot, therefore, reproduce them. When women are full civic participants in both senses, when they both receive their full due from the state and are free to make their maximum contribution to it, we will have left far behind the notion that power is our first organizing principle and be well on our way to embracing respect, the foundation of democratic governance, as its replacement. Thank you.
Though I agree with most of what you said, I felt your talk was rather short in terms of giving us specific ways in which this horrific society you seem to feel we now live in can specifically change to move us away from these horrors that surround us.
I'm trying to think where to begin. In a way that won't have me talking for another hour and a half. One of the things that I have come up against as a lawyer working in this field is the fundamental conviction that law has only a very limited part of the answer. And when John Stuart Mill talks, or I talk about the family as the place where values are shaped, I think I'm coming to a conviction that we won't make radical changes in practices of violence against women or in the society as a whole unless we can model relationships of respect in the home. Now, the question of how you begin to do that and where, as a generational matter, you can intercede is a very tricky question, I think. One of the things that I'm delighted to see happening in the most recent years is a focus on the impact on children of witnessing violence at home. Because I think that if we can really open our eyes to everything that that means from children, both in terms of their own traumatic reactions to it and also in terms of the social learning that gets done, and begin to intervene with those children and show them that there is a different way of organizing their human relationships, then it seems to me that would be one very sort of potent place to start.
This is a two-part question.
Oh, I shall have to write it down.
I've saw some studies in the last few weeks talking about attacking women where we always thought rape was tremendous anger, turning it into now thought of more a sexual behavior. And I wondered what you thought about that and what the ramifications of that. And the second thing that I've read is that it seems every time a woman gets a restraining order, she's murdered. I've never seen anything like it. It's always a huge proportion of people, as soon as they get that restraining order against the man, something violent happens, and I wonder if there is another means of handling this.
Can I answer the second part first? I think it's the easier of the two. It is true that a number of women are murdered after they take a serious step towards leaving their abusive partner. That happens because you're talking about someone who has a very limited notion of how to hold someone in a relationship with him. And so if violence is his way, then if she ups the ante by saying that she's going to leave, he is most likely to respond with more of the same. It can be filing a restraining order, it can be moving out, it can be filing for divorce, whatever that sort of definitive step is. On the other hand, it really isn't a large proportion or percentage of women who get restraining orders who are murdered. And it is important to recognize that for many women, the restraining order is in fact a step towards securing her safety and her independence. What it means, though, is that if you are in a position of advocating with a woman, safety planning is step one, and the restraining order is going to be step five or step six. You have to be sure that the restraining order is safe for her, or you have to have her thoughtful decision that the restraining order makes her more safe rather than less before you go to get it. The rape part of the question. I find this discussion an enormously difficult one. And in most instances like that, I want it to be both and. In other words, it seems to me that rape is a practice that surely is complex enough to have more than one meaning in different contexts. But obviously the fear is culturally that if we define it as sex rather than violence, we're going to feel more benevolent towards its perpetrators and less concerned to have them accountable for their actions. And that's something to be wary of.
The New York Times reported in November of last year that the title of the article is "Crackdown on Abusive Spouses Surprisingly Nets Many Women," and refers in Concord, New Hampshire, nearly 35% of the domestic assault arrests this year have been of women, and some parallels in other states. And I wonder what you make of this.
Let me talk for a moment about men getting restraining orders against women. I think it is obviously true that some men are physically and emotionally abused by women. There's no reason to suppose that that's not true. There's also reason to suppose that it's very difficult for men to blow the whistle in that kind of a situation because it is so palpably not what is expected for a guy that he is being bullied or intimidated by his female partner. So to that extent, it may even be true that the abuse of men by women is somewhat underreported if you look at police statistics. On the other hand, the business of men getting restraining orders is also being driven by at least two other forces. The first is that we've had a rash of state legislation making arrest mandatory when the police arrive at the scene of a domestic incident and the perpetrator is still present. Police are very unhappy about having their discretion around arrest curtailed. One of the ways in which they have responded to that unhappiness is that if there is any he said, she said, when they arrive at the scene, they will arrest both parties, and then both parties will go forward to seek restraining orders. It may still, in fact, and is usually the case, that one of the parties is the primary aggressor. And it may be that in as many as 9 out of 10 cases, the primary aggressor is the man. The other thing is that most restraining order legislation includes in it provisions for getting temporary custody of children. Males are now being advised by their lawyers that if their partner takes out a restraining order against them, they should immediately go into court and take out a parallel restraining order, and they should also seek temporary custody of the children.
So I think that this business of the restraining orders is, again, a very complex one. It's being driven by sort of multiple factors. And nobody should look at it as a simple demonstration that women are turning as violent as men.
In response to your idea that battered women especially are barred from full participation in democracy, I wonder if you've put forth any theories on the effect that it has on the rest of women in society that are not on the battering continuum per se, but is there some sort of continuum or domino effect that in which we all are a part? Because if someone were sitting here saying, well, I'm not in a battering relationship, I guess everything's okay for me.
Yes. That actually is exactly where at about 4 o'clock today, I was thinking, gee, if there's one more piece that I should really try to fit in here, it would be that one. And then didn't have the leisure to sort of develop it. But it does seem to me that when you have as much domestic violence as we do, and it taints the lives of so many, indirectly, if not directly. I mean, in my own family, I learned as an adult that my father's father had been abusive towards his wife, my grandmother, and towards him. Knowing that, I can see the emotional ramifications down the generations, and I can see in my father some of the controlling tendencies of abusive men, even though he forswore violence and never raised a hand to anyone. But if you think about it in that way, you know, how many of us, if we looked at our extended families or we looked back a couple of generations, wouldn't find abuse? And then you think about those sort of emotional patterns of behavior. I think you could very clearly say that we all, as women, still inherit some of this social tradition.
If women who are physically abused or emotionally battered are removed from the political conversation, then we've lost a huge percentage of the political conversation, and if they are constrained at home, they are not going to be participating in elections. And that was what I thought you were going towards with the title of the speech. So I was hoping you could say a little bit about that.
Well, I did indeed mean to be making the connection between the two types of civic participation that I talked about. In other words, just as you say, if women are not in the voting booth, then they are not part of a political process that is going to give us leaders who have a greater incentive to put women's full equality on the agenda. So we need to be working, it seems to me, on both sides at once. And then the only sort of mitigating thing that I wanted to say at the end is that, in fact, it is experiences of abuse that have brought many women, you know, out of those experiences and into political life. So that we have, for example, been successful in getting the Violence Against Women Act passed by the Congress. What we're in a struggle about, interestingly enough, is the civil rights piece of the Violence Against Women Act, which is the piece that says violence against women is a violation of their civil rights. It is a public wrong, not just a private wrong. It happens to women because they are women, right? That is the most contested piece of that legislation.
Thank you all for your wise and insightful questions.
You've been listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals, programming from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. The Institute invites your comments on the series, Feminisms and the Practice of Democracy, via their website at www.radcliffe.edu/feminisms. The producer for this series is Laura Ross-Kos, director of the Graduate Consortium in Women's Studies. Thank you for joining us.